From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. If you plan to follow the WUSA playoffs, don't blink. Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of the four women's teams vying to attend next weekend's championship game. Also, the WNBA gambles on a Connecticut squad struggling to emerge from the shadow of UConn and the casino it calls home. Also ahead on Only a Game, a profile of a Frenchman preparing to free fall 25 miles to Earth, and urban anglers of New York scoff at Knickerbocker naysayers.
There was a little girl sitting next to me, and she was telling me, nobody ever fishes here. It's silly. Don't fish here. And I said, well, there's fish in the water, young lady.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. There were cheers in the streets of New York City last night in the last of the neighborhoods to get their power restored. Beth Fertig of member station WNYC has more.
The power company Con Edison announced that all customer service was back just after 9 o'clock Eastern time. One part of Brooklyn and areas south of Midtown Manhattan were among the last neighborhoods to be restored, but the city was already well on its way. Broadway shows were open Friday night, and the Mets were playing at Shea Stadium. Meanwhile, Mayor Michael Bloomberg praised New Yorkers as he compared the blackout of 2003 to the last one in 1977. Instead of chaos and crime, he said, this time there was calm and compassion. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
Power officials say it could be days or weeks before they know what caused this week's massive power outage. The U.S. and Canada formed a joint task force yesterday to conduct an investigation. The blackout cut power to parts of eight states and Canada in just 9 seconds. Montana residents are bracing themselves for possible power outages because of wildfires. Northwestern Energy Company officials say fires in western Montana are threatening some of their electrical transmission lines. There are now about a dozen fires burning in the state. Tropical storm Erica has now moved to the coast near Brownsville, Texas. It's threatening to reach hurricane strength. The storm is now less than 45 miles southeast of Brownsville. Its 70-mile-per-hour winds are just 4 miles per hour below the hurricane threshold. Ed Thompson reports.
It was about 1 a.m. Central Time when Erica's outer rain bands began pounding the Brownsville area with rain that could eventually total as much as 6 inches. That prompted officials to close the Queen Isabella Causeway, a nearly 2.5-mile-long bridge that is the only route between South Padre Island and Port Isabella, just north of where Erica is predicted to make landfall. Those who did not make it inland will have to ride out the storm on the island. Early this morning, people began streaming into the 11 county-run shelters. Many of the evacuees are recent Mexican immigrants fleeing the quagmires that are sure to develop as rain soaks their small, unpaved neighborhoods. To the south, in Mexico, shelters were opened a day early for an anticipated 15,000 evacuees from low-lying coastal areas. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson reporting.
A federal judge may postpone California's gubernatorial recall election over voting rights questions. U.S. District Judge Jeremy Fogel says issues raised by two civil rights groups need to be sorted out. Under the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the federal government must approve voting changes in four California counties with a history of low participation. A court challenge focuses on Monterey County, which plans fewer Spanish-speaking poll workers for the election. The judge has scheduled another hearing for August 29th. This is NPR. One of Africa's most brutal dictators is dead. Former Ugandan President Idi Amin died in exile in Saudi Arabia this morning. Amin was driven from power in 1979 by forces from neighboring Tanzania and by Ugandan exiles. Some exiles accused Amin of keeping severed heads in his refrigerator and other atrocities. The White House says tough U.S. sanctions against Libya will remain in place, despite that country's acceptance of responsibility for the bomb attack that brought down a Pan Am jumbo jet in 1988. The sanctions, which have had a significant impact on Libya's economy, include travel restrictions and restraints on U.S. business deals with Libya. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The letter of responsibility from the Libyan government was part of a settlement with the families of the 270 victims of the attack, most of them Americans. Each family is expected to get at least $5 million. The letter also said that Libya renounces terrorism. But while officials say the U.S. will not stand in the way of a lifting of U.N. sanctions, the sanctions imposed by the United States will remain in effect. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan issued a statement saying the U.S. still has serious concerns with Libya and will intensify efforts to end threatening elements of that country's behavior. He cited Libya's poor human rights record, its lack of democratic institutions, what he called its destructive role in regional conflicts, and its suspected pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Oil has stopped flowing through Iraq's pipeline to Turkey because of damage from a fire. It took 24 hours to extinguish the blaze. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This weekend's Women's United Soccer Association semifinal games will decide which WUSA teams will face each other next Sunday in San Diego in Founders Cup 3, the league's championship. Tomorrow afternoon in Atlanta, the Beat will host the San Diego Spirit, and this afternoon in Boston, the Breakers will play the Washington Freedom. After Thursday's Breakers practice, I spoke with Boston goalkeeper Karina LeBlanc and asked her if she'd be feeling more pressure than normal in her team's first ever playoff appearance.
I don't think so. I think we've faced Washington several times this season and in the past seasons, and we know what to expect. I think if we start putting pressure on ourselves, you know, we'll change the way we play. If I put more pressure on myself, I may not perform like I have been. So I'm just going to treat this like another game and, you know, hopefully I can do what I've been doing and the team will do what they've been doing and we'll be successful.
You have maybe the best perspective of anybody on the field to talk about how the Breakers have evolved from a team that didn't make the playoffs the first two seasons to a team that finished on top at the end of the regular season this year. What's different?
I think the biggest thing is we gained confidence. At the beginning of the season, you know, we started off the season on a sour note. You know, we lost 6-0 in Atlanta. We had a couple losses under our belt, and we just decided to make a difference. And from then on, it was confidence. We found ways to win games we shouldn't have necessarily won or get points out of games that last year we would have lost. And I think that strictly came from confidence from the coaching staff all the way down to, you know, our trainers. You know, we had people on the sidelines cheering us on if we did something wrong. And it was just a solid team effort. And I think that was the difference.
One of the sort of developments that it seems to me has happened with this team is when the defenders and the midfielders are bringing the ball out of the Boston end, there seems to be a much greater degree of organization, a much greater sense of, okay, let's find the person who's going to be making a run on the flank rather than let's get the ball the heck out of here because it's in a dangerous place.
Yeah, I think that comes to confidence. Again, we're willing to take risks, willing to try new things. And from doing that, you expand your game. And I think everybody in our team has done that to the level where everybody's game has risen. And so now we're willing to try playing the ball out of the back. And I think that's been the biggest difference for us. We're willing to take chances out there. And that's how you go from being an average team to a great team.
Great team needs a great goalkeeper. All you did was win Player of the Week last week. Tell me a little bit about your own development as a keeper.
I think for me personally, I still have a long way to go before I get to the goalkeeper I want to be. But I'm not complaining about where I am right now.
I mean, neither is anybody else on the Breakers.
I think, you know what, it has a lot to do, like I've always said, about confidence. I know that I have the confidence from my teammates. And that helps me. And like I said, I'll go out there and take risks in the goal. I'll go out for a ball that last year I was playing a lot more conservative.
You spoke about having played Washington four times, if you count the preseason. You're familiar with Washington. Washington is familiar with you. Are there wrinkles you can still throw at them, or is this just going to be a case of two teams that know each other very well and the one that plays harder is the one likely to prevail?
Most definitely. I think it comes down to whoever has the better game because there's no surprises. You know, we can't throw on a player that they don't know, or we can't do a set play that they don't know. I mean, the thing with this league is that, you know, even if we threw a little trick in a game against San Diego, you know, Washington can watch the tape and see it. So, I mean, it's definitely just going to come down to which team steps up and which team plays better, because both teams have phenomenal players. You know, we have Christine Lilly, we have Dogny. It goes all the way down into the people who step onto the field, even if it's in the 85th minute. You know, and Washington has, we have a lot of respect for their team, but it's going to come down to who performs better. And that's the great thing about playoffs. You know, the teams that are there deserve to be there, and it's the team that performs on that day that will advance.
Must be a very nice feeling to be one of those teams that deserves to be
Finally.
There.
Finally! It's been a long time waiting. Yeah, I mean, last two seasons have just been disappointing because, you know, we'd go into preseason feeling that, you know, we had, especially on paper, we had what was necessary. But, you know, what you find out is about team sports is that individuals can't shine. A whole team has to shine, and I think that's what's happened here this year.
Well, congratulations on a wonderful
Thank you.
Season. Corinna LeBlanc mines the net for the Breakers. She and her teammates will take on the Washington Freedom at 4 o'clock this afternoon at Nickerson Field in Boston. Making your way to a Connecticut Sun home game is not like making your way to a game anywhere else in the WNBA. Unless you know the underground route favored by the Connecticut Sun players to get to the arena, you pass from any of several parking lots through at least one enormous room filled with the electronic hum of expectation and with rows and rows and rows of slot machines. Unlike most of their sister teams in the WNBA, the Sun do not share an address with an NBA club. When the team that was the Orlando Miracle until the end of last summer was reincarnated as the Sun for the current season, it moved in next door to the Mohegan Sun Casino in a little corner of Indian Country in Connecticut, now notorious for its legal opportunities to gamble. A significant distraction, according to Adam Zagoria, who covers women's basketball for the Herald News of West Paterson, New Jersey.
Well, I got drawn in by the slot machines today with my colleague from the New York Times, and I held my limit after $15 worth of quarters, and Lena walked away with about $30 in quarters there. I think it's just that New York Times luck. I hope I'm not getting her in trouble here, but... Yeah, she's at the big paper. She's got the karma with her.
Mr. Zagoria's haplessness notwithstanding, in the Sun locker room before the game against the New York Liberty on Tuesday night, 6'4" center/forward Jesse Hicks, a 5-year veteran of the WNBA, shrugged off the significance of the glittering and noisy next-door neighbor.
When we come in, we drive through the tunnel, and we never get to see the casino unless we're, you know, sightseeing or whatever. But, I mean, you got security, the same everywhere else. Game day preparation is the same. And I play down in Orlando and in Utah. It's the same to me.
But what about as a player coming in? I mean, you come around the corner of the highway and you see this gigantic alien-looking structure rising out of the plane. It must be somehow a little intimidating to some of the opposition, I would think.
Well, yeah, I would think, too. I hope so. And we're hoping that they'll have such a good time that they won't be, like, focused on the ball game.
That's a strategy that has worked imperfectly this summer. Going into Tuesday night's game, the Sun, 14-14 overall, was only 8-6 at home. Not much evidence of a home court advantage there. Still, Taj McWilliams-Franklin, the Sun's 33-year-old starting center, prefers the team's union with a casino to a partnership with an NBA organization.
It's been great. You know, you get all the attention. You don't have to worry about some players bringing people in to try out and this and this. You can't use the locker room right now because some of the men are in there. It's yours. It's ours. It's the Connecticut Sun. We're the only team here. We basically get everything. We get all the goodies, all the trinkets, everything, and all the attention. And, you know, we're women, so we love attention.
Everybody loves attention.
Yeah.
That doesn't have anything to do with gender.
But we really love it.
The flip side of going solo is that the Sun can't take advantage of another team's fan base. A certain number of New York Knicks, Los Angeles Lakers, and Detroit Pistons fans take in the odd Liberty, Sparks, or Shock game. The Sun had hoped to make up for that disadvantage with Connecticut fans who've been taught to love the game by the exceptionally successful UConn women's team. But as current son and former UConn star Rebecca Lobo explains, the transfer of loyalties has been incomplete at best.
I think a lot of people, including myself, just thought that because it was in Connecticut, we would draw. But then I kind of sat back and realized, you know, my freshman year at UConn, we probably drew about 4,000 or 5,000. But we built that program. We built it by being successful and winning, and then the fans came. And, you know, maybe we were expecting a little too much to just anticipate a UConn-like crowd from year one.
It may come across as, hey, all you guys have to do is go undefeated and win a championship, and people will come.
No, I mean, well, actually, that's been one hard thing, is to explain to the fans in this state that it is abnormal for teams to go undefeated. It's abnormal for teams to win every game by 30. I actually had a fan say to me just last week, you know, great win the other night, but you guys need to win by more.
Lobo's teammates began Tuesday night's game as if they intended to win by a great deal. Irrepressible guard Nikisha Sales, also a UConn alum and former national champ, led the Sun to early leads of 11-4 and 18-11. At the half, Sales had outscored the whole New York team, 23-21, and the Sun was up 15. Before the game, Taj McWilliams-Franklin, frustrated at trying to explain why the Sun was stuck at 500, had characterized her team as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Whichever of those guys can't play defense against three-point shooters showed up for the second half against the Liberty. New York scored 52 points, winning the game after a technical foul in the final seconds when the Sun tried to call a timeout they didn't have. It was, finally, not a performance calculated to win over fans whom UConn has taught to value and expect discipline, poise, and consistency. Thursday night's scheduled game between Connecticut and the Cleveland Rockers in Cleveland was postponed due to the blackout. For the Sun, which plays the Liberty in New York this afternoon, the playoff picture is very cloudy, although not yet quite entirely dark.
Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Ah, the summer fair season. The shrieks of children on the Ferris wheel, the smells of caramel corn and fried dough, the thrill of the cockroach races. At the Indiana State Fair, cockroaches run around a tiny track twice a day. Each roach has a dot of paint on his or her back, strictly for identification purposes, since betting is forbidden. Some of the roaches, the large muscular Madagascar variety, pull small green tractors behind them. Asked why people watch the races, Arwin Provancha, the roach race announcer, shrugged and said people are fascinated by things that repulse them. As they leave the races, Provancha warns the crowd, folks, don't try this at home.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, the Yankees beat Baltimore 6-4. Cleveland needed but one run in their shutout win against Tampa Bay. Minnesota clobbered Kansas City 9-2. Texas topped Chicago 11-5. And Anaheim bested Detroit 3-1. Elsewhere, Toronto vanquished Oakland 8-5. And Seattle doubled up Boston by a score of 10-5. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Carlo Rotella about his new boxing book, Cut Time. But first, a parachutist from France with more than 8,000 jumps to his credit is in Canada this month to attempt the jump of his career. Retired Colonel Michel Fournier hopes his third attempt at the world record for the highest and fastest jump will also make him the first person to break the sound barrier in a free fall. He chose to make his dangerous jump in a remote corner of Canada after being denied access to the crowded airspace over France. Amy Jo Eman has this report from Fournier's jump site.
The airport outside North Battleford doesn't see a lot of traffic. There are no scheduled passenger flights. The silence is broken only occasionally by a personal aircraft, a charter now and then, and a daily courier flight. It was a busy pilot training base during World War II, but today the wind blows through an old broken-down hangar and rustles the weeds growing along the tarmac. It's the perfect place to inflate a 20-story-high helium balloon, launch it into the stratosphere, and watch a human being plummet to Earth.
Well, it's certainly a bizarre dream for somebody. I don't think I would do it myself.
Randy Sterlioff oversees the airport at North Battleford, a city of 15,000, surrounded by flat open prairie farms in western Canada.
I'm sure that there'll be a good crowd of people here, watching the launch. It's not the space shuttle, but it's still pretty exciting for us.
The balloon's gondola is hauled out of storage. One imagines a quaint wicker basket with a celebratory bottle of champagne inside. But this gondola and its passenger must withstand the extremes of air pressure, solar radiation, and temperature 25 miles above the Earth.
Okay, bring my head, Bill. Good. Oh, yeah, there's about 4 inches there.
What emerges from the hangar is a 10-foot cylinder that looks a little like a giant silver thermos. Inside, there's barely enough room for a chair, several gauges and monitors, video cameras, and bottled oxygen. The plexiglass door slides open and shut, giving it the appearance of an airworthy shower stall. Michel Fournier helps to guide the gondola onto the tarmac. He's a 59-year-old retired Army colonel, a fit and handsome Frenchman wearing aviator sunglasses. In 40 years, Fournier has made more than 8,000 parachute jumps around the world. His next jump, he's dubbed the Super Jump. If successful, Fournier will break the record for the highest jump, almost 25 miles up, the longest free fall, 6 minutes and 25 seconds before his parachute opens, and the fastest jump, breaking the sound barrier at speeds as high as 1,000 miles per hour. I asked Fournier if he's worried for his life. He answers through a translator, Claude Jean Harel, his Canadian host.
Non, je ne vois pas. Premièrement, pourquoi j'y perdrais la vie? Parce que
I don't see how I would lose my life. He says. Ouais. So there's no real danger in his opinion because he's trained and he knows also that his team would not let him do the jump without being sure that this was entirely safe.
And Fournier has had time to prepare. In the 1980s, he was chosen for this jump as part of the European Space Program. The project was scrapped for lack of funds. But Fournier didn't quit. He raised $10.5 million U.S. to buy the equipment and do it himself.
Michel has basically sold everything he owned to finance this project. He sold his land, his house, his furniture. He sold his gun collection. And he's invested everything into this.
More than 45 companies are providing state-of-the-art technology for this jump, like the pressurized spacesuit Fournier will wear. It's made of a new synthetic material able to withstand temperatures of 150 degrees Fahrenheit below zero. Medical science is watching this jump to better understand the effects of atmospheric extremes on the circulatory and respiratory systems. Sport medicine is interested in the psychological preparation for such an ordeal. And NASA is also watching to assess the feasibility of installing emergency ejection capsules on the space shuttle. For these reasons, Fournier says this is much more than an extreme sport.
C'est un projet qui est scientifique, ce n'est pas une cascade.
If it was just a stunt, he would not be interested in it to the same extent as he is now because it is grounded in science and discovery, and the balloon can only be used once. So you want to make sure it's the right one when you do it.
More than 50 French experts are expected to be on hand for Fournier's death-defying jump. His team includes the shuttle astronaut Jean-François Clairvoy and the test pilot of the Concorde, André Turcat. Also expected to be on hand for the jump is the current parachute record holder, retired U.S. Air Force pilot Joseph Kittinger, who jumped from 20 miles up in 1960. Exactly when this so-called super jump will take place is up in the air. Fournier's team is watching and waiting for the perfect weather conditions, an early morning with almost no wind within the 2 weeks beginning August 23rd. Only then will Michel Fournier rise in his gondola 25 miles above the Earth, open the door, and take a small step into the great abyss of space. For Only a Game, I'm Amy Jo Eamon in North Battleford, Canada.
Early in Cut Time, his book subtitled An Education at the Fights, author Carlo Rotella writes of an amateur boxer who says of himself, "Once I found boxing, I got disciplined about everything, school, eating, sleeping, everything." Understanding and learning from the world of boxing has become not only part of Carlo Rotella's own regimen of discipline, but part of the way he has come to understand the human condition itself. The author of Cut Time joins me now in the studio. Mr. Rotella, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The fighter of whom I spoke, whose name is Russell, was a student of yours when you were teaching at Lafayette College sometime between 94 and 97. I gather he did not surprise you when he spoke of what boxing had given him.
Well, I was at first surprised that he boxed at all, but that began to explain the damage on his face in the classroom. But he didn't surprise me in the sense that he had sort of snapped into focus during the semester, and I was wondering why. And that came out as the reason.
In the book, you discuss going to the gym where Larry Holmes worked out. It was a kind of antidote to the academic life for you during this time at Lafayette. How did that work?
Yes, in a sense it was an antidote. And in another sense, it was the other game in town. Lafayette is a beautiful college on a very steep hill overlooking a fairly hard-boiled town, mm-hmm. eastern Pennsylvania. And Holmes's gym is down by the canal and the railroad tracks in an old welding shop. And I moved there. It was my first academic job. And I went for a walk to explore the town and find out what was going on in it. And among the somewhat limited number of things to do in that town was to hang out at the Holmes gym. And I got curious about the kind of teaching and learning that went on there. And then when it turned out that Holmes and I had this student in common, I started hanging around with a little more purpose there.
So you didn't go in with an idea of as long as Holmes's gym is here, I might as well get in shape and maybe see if I can take a punch.
No, I've never had that impulse at all. I found my way in there one day on a walk, and I came back because I wanted to understand what it was I was looking at. I could see the surface of what I was looking at, and I wanted to understand a little bit about what was moving beneath that surface. And the initial thing that really attracted me was that there were students there to learn, and there were people teaching, but teachers weren't coming all the way to the students or making an effort to teach the students. The students were watching the mm-hmm. more experienced fighters, and the more experienced fighters were simply going about their business in a fairly self-absorbed, even selfish way. And the students, the younger fighters, the apprentices, were paying attention. And that appealed to me as somebody teaching up on the hill, that the students came so far to their teachers.
It strikes me that there'd be another thing that might appeal to a college professor, which is if a student wasn't paying attention, two things might happen. One, he might get his block knocked off. And the other is he might be allowed to simply wander away from the gym and not come back. Okay, that's one we're not going to get.
Absolutely. I mean, the phrase I use a couple times in the book is knowledge with consequences. And that's part of what appealed to me is that, you know, many of the lessons that boxing teaches are hard lessons or unfair, or lessons about how unfair life is, but they're always supercharged with these immediate consequences. You do things wrong and you persist in doing things wrong, you pay for them.
There is some glorious and perhaps unexpected comic relief in this book, particularly when you discuss what sometimes happens to the people who try to sing the national anthem before a fight. Tell us about the somewhat less than illustrious Mookie.
Well, Mookie, like a lot of people who try to sing the national anthem at the fights, had his brainwaves scrambled basically by the fight milieu. And I would say it's more common than not for somebody to blow the national anthem at the fights. Mm-hmm. And in his case, he got to "Oh Say Can You See" and then forgot the rest of the national anthem. And he had a beautiful voice, and there was this very long pause, and in that pause he had a very deep, he sounded like Lou Rawls, he just said, "Oh God." And then just free associated, he just sang, he said, "Clouds, flags," and just... But, you know, it took him as long as the national anthem to sing it. And he had things that, like, rockets appeared at a certain point because there are rockets in there.
And he remembered rockets were there, just didn't know where.
And the beauty of it was as he got to the end, he picked it right up, the last two lines, as if he had just sung the whole national anthem. And, he came to a beautiful conclusion.
Terrific.
And I assume there was tumultuous applause.
Yes, this was in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in the ballroom of the Days Inn in Allentown, Pennsylvania. People are very patriotic there, and they were rooting for him to make it to the finish line.
You turn an intriguing corner fairly late in the book, and you establish a comparison between the challenges a boxer faces and the circumstances with which your grandmother, your own grandmother, struggles as she grows old. Did that analogy occur to you early, I mean, before you started the book, or was that something you learned you were going to write about as you went along?
I think the germ of that analogy occurred to me from a vivid image, which was of an ex-fighter in his 70s named Bojack standing in the middle of the ring. He'd been invited up in the ring to take his bows before a fight, and the way he was standing, he hooked his cane around his elbow, and he was sort of standing with his hands in the air, mitting the crowd, as fighters used to do. Mm-hmm. And he had false teeth, and he was kind of chomping his false teeth and trying to stay up on his feet. And in that moment, he looked so much like my grandmother, and especially like my grandmother getting through a big ritual occasion, like a wedding or something. It was one of those moments where I said to myself, well, I'm going to have to figure out what's inside of here, you know, what this visual connection might suggest about a deeper connection. And then that deeper connection, I think, turned out to be a lesson in the way people ration themselves and pace themselves through their lives so that they have enough left to do the things that are most important to them. In my grandmother's case, that was going to Sicily every year to go to her husband's graveside.
She had to rest for months before making the journey.
Well, she had to be there on November 2nd, which is All Souls' Day, so she would start training basically in September. She lived in New York and Queens, and she would cut back on her movements through the world and stop going to church as much and stop wasting energy and basically save it up because mm-hmm. especially as she got older, she had to get through airports, she had to visit with relatives, she had to eat food that had not been prepared by her, and then when she got all the way to Sicily, she had to walk up this hill to get to the cemetery, and she had to do it every day. And basically, you could see her year as rationing herself so there would be enough left of her to do this thing she needed to do every year. And doing it, even though it was difficult, kept her alive to do it again mm-hmm. the next year. Mm-hmm.
Just as perhaps Bojack was kept alive by the opportunity to maybe 6 months later climb through the ropes one more time to the applause of fight fans.
It's true. And of course, you don't want to completely idealize it because the reason that he's so admired is because he took a lot of pounding early on in his life, not just dishing it out, but taking it. So there's always this kind of race between, on the one hand, experience and the other, accruing damage. And it's that kind of calculus that it's one of those lessons that is very sharply rendered in the fight world, but the lesson travels through the ropes fairly far from the fight world, like, say, to my Sicilian grandmother.
Have you said what you have to say about boxing now that you've written this book, or does boxing remain a fascination? Will you keep attending the fights and perhaps writing about them some more?
I would say that I don't intend to write another book about boxing next, but that I have no intention of getting away completely from the fight world. And I think more importantly, I'm interested in those worlds like the fight world, and in some ways like the academy, that appear to be really cut off from the rest of the world, but in fact are connected to it in subterranean ways. So these days I'm writing about music, for instance, especially blues, and that's a sort of a similar insular world that turns out to be deeply connected to this larger world around it.
Carlo Rotella is the author of Cut Time, An Education at the Fights, published by Houghton Mifflin. Carlo, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Addressing the Only a Game staff collectively as gentle persons, David Dambly emailed recently to say, "As one who has virtually no interest in sports, I have come to love listening to your remarkable show." So I guess we're doing something right. Or wrong. an appreciator of the occasional doggerel on the show, Susan Jo Russell, a WBUR listener, sent along a sonnet on the subject of a treasured Red Sox coffee mug which recently broke. Extrapolating from her own misfortune, Ms. Russell uses the third quatrain and final couplet to warn the team she loves. Beware, my team, where dangers lurk, a slippery patch of dampened earth, the corner of the bag at third, an overlooked doggy turd. Oh, slip not now at summer's end, like my poor cup that will not mend. Overlooked is downright Elizabethan, don't you think? It's just remarkable. Among the subjects various listeners wrote to tout as future Only a Game stories are an upcoming All-Star National Scrabble Tournament, the allegedly remarkable success of female jockeys at Suffolk Downs in East Boston, the 5th annual U.S. National Kayak Polo Championships coming up in Los Angeles, and fantasy football as it's played in Hopkins, Minnesota. We try, folks, but we only have an hour a week. John McLeese emailed to speculate on what he termed an enigma. In my newspaper, he wrote, chess tournament results are not placed in the sports section, yet the result of a billiards tournament is. What is sport? Regarding Pippin Ross's story on the production of Damn Yankees starring ex-Red Sox general manager Dan Duquette, several listeners, including Juliet Cunningham and Richard Binder, wrote to take issue with the phrase fictional Washington Senators. Folks, the real Washington Senators were busy playing baseball when the play was initially produced many years ago, and my guess is most of them couldn't sing much. Finally, Jennifer Rain left this encouraging message on the listener line.
I'm not a sports person, but I not only love to listen to stories that you have on the air, but you have the best laugh ever.
Well, some people have actually characterized it as a cackle. Anyway, the listener line number is 617-353-1860. You can email us by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. Old-fashioned mail will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway on a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, the Cubs edged Los Angeles 2-1. Montreal exposed San Francisco by a score of 4-1. Philadelphia foiled St. Louis 7-4. Pittsburgh beat Milwaukee 6-3. Cincinnati downed Houston 9-7, and the Mets blanked Colorado 5-0. Elsewhere, Atlanta beat Arizona 10-4, and Florida shut out San Diego 10-0. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, New York City's Hudson, Harlem, and East Rivers as angling destinations, even during blackouts. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Bill, is that you, Bill?
See, we're okay up here. There were only three postponements of professional sports games on the first night of the country's worst ever blackout. The Mets did not play the Giants, and two WNBA games did not occur. So I ask you, why couldn't there have been more?
It was getaway day, obviously. Everyone was playing in the afternoon. All over baseball, the Red Sox played a big game out and managed to win a big game out in Oakland that started in the afternoon. You look at something like this, and you look at it from the tiny little prism of the sports world, and you say, by God, we sure do depend on electricity for lots of stuff.
Can't be any question of that. Tiger Woods, 4-over-74 in the first round of this week's PGA Championship, further fueled discussion of Commissioner Eldrick's, quote, slump, end quote. Can Woods' apparently soon-to-be majorless 2003 golf season be fairly construed as such?
You know what? By the standards he set for himself when he first came on the tour, he's in a slump. He hasn't won a major.
Mm-hmm.
By everyone else's standards, he's had a pretty good year. Thursday was absolutely dreadful. He hit only 5 of 14 fairways. He didn't meet the media, which he almost always does. This is a tournament that's generally won by somebody out of the back of the field, and it looks like it's going to be again.
The U.S. men's basketball team, which was rudely bounced out of last year's World Championships, will begin training tomorrow, preparing for Olympic qualifying tournament, which begins Wednesday in Puerto Rico. Kind of a sad thing that they have to qualify, but there you are. Does this squad avenge last year's, as George Carter might put it, humiliation?
I think it could. I think there are a couple of elements on the team that I take issue with. As you know, I'm adamantly opposed to anybody who's already won a gold medal getting another chance. So Karl Malone, I don't think, needs to be on the team. I don't think Vince Carter should be on the team because he's a joke and he embarrassed himself the last time he played internationally. I am enormously happy that Allen Iverson is on the team because I think there's anybody on this team understands the length you have to go sometimes to succeed in this country. It's Allen Iverson. As far as I'm concerned, if he makes the Olympic team, he should carry the flag in the parade. My biggest question, and I think everyone who follows basketball question, is where's LeBron? How can you have a team without LeBron? Where is he?
The rumored midweek deal between the New Jersey Nets and Portland Trailblazers had Kenyon Martin and Dikembe Mutombo going west and Rasheed Wallace and Reuben Patterson heading east. Assuming that there was a germ of truth to this rumor, what were the Nets thinking?
Well, the Nets are understanding that they have mutually reached the end of their respective ropes, which weren't very long to start with, and they're trying to get the best that they can. And the Portland Trailblazers are, of course, trying to eliminate their image as the NBA's chain gang, and they're getting rid of Rasheed Wallace and Reuben Patterson to that effect. I don't see any way, unless he evinces a kind of humility he has not evinced in his entire public career, that Kenyon Martin can come back to the Nets. I mean, he's been very, very vocal in his desire to get a new deal. Jason Kidd has jumped in. I mean, that was a team very delicately balanced, and he's thrown it out of balance.
The Seattle Supersonics, losers of many games, and according to them, millions and millions of dollars over the last few years, this team has decided to reduce its salary cap in an extremely creative way, don't you think?
Yeah, this is really going to promote morale through the entire operation. They're laying off six employees. They missed the playoffs. They supposedly lost $17 million last year. I don't believe that for a moment. All of a sudden you've got the owner talking about the fact that because the city owns the arena, they're at a competitive disadvantage. Guess what? I have a feeling that even though Harvey Schultz, the Starbucks coffee impresario who owns the team, says he'll honor the lease, which runs through the 2010 season, that's very nice of him, by the way, you know that the call for some sort of taxpayer-financed gravy train for the Latte King is coming down the road.
Gravy train for the Latte King is nice.
Or latte train for the gravy king.
I hesitate to broach the subject, but more ghoulish goings-on regarding the body of Ted Williams, courtesy of Sports Illustrated. It's in the news again. I wish the story would go away, but since it hasn't gone away, why does anybody bother with this so-called cryopreservation anyway?
Because it is lurid and tawdry, and we devour lurid and tawdry like our morning M&Ms in this country. And I thought Bill Walton was the most famous deadhead in professional sports.
On a more serious note, Herb Brooks, coach of the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team, passed away on Monday. Charlie, it's interesting to me that although Brooks had a long career in hockey at all kinds of different levels from college on up, It is the so-called miracle on ice for which he is remembered, isn't
it? He was more than just a motivational genius who pulled off one of the great upsets in all of international sports. He was a really good hockey coach. He was a really good hockey coach at the University of Minnesota before the Olympics. He was a really good hockey coach in the NHL with some pretty mediocre teams after the Olympics. And he came back as an Olympic coach and won a silver medal in a great game against the Canadiens. But undoubtedly because of the kind of, you know, social and geopolitical incrustation that's formed over that game, that's what he'll be remembered for, and that's not entirely a bad thing.
In the Life Imitates Art department, there is intrigue and mayhem rampant on the Bassmaster Tour. It reminds one of Carl Hiaasen's fishing thriller Double Whammy, doesn't it?
Yeah, they had Carl Hiaasen wrote me one of his very fine mystery novels about a murder in a fishing tournament. Lo and behold, down in Belle Chasse, Louisiana, the second place finisher at the Citgo Bassmaster Classic got a pot shot taken at him, allegedly from Dale Silbernagel of Venice, Louisiana, who apparently took offense at the wake left by the bass boat of Gary Klein. First of all, it's going to get a huge television contract the next time Bassmaster comes up.
If you're
allowed to take pot shots from onshore.
If there's small arms fire involved,
Fox is bidding already. You know that. And the sheriff says, I'm sure he will claim it was a warning shot, but we don't want people to take the law into their own hands. We wouldn't expect a citizen in a subdivision to shoot at someone speeding down the street. Why not?
There is once again controversy regarding doping, this time in Springfield, Illinois. And I ask, where is the World Anti-Doping Agency when you need it?
Moo. There's a 1,294-pound Maine Anjou steer named Bongo was stripped of his title because he tested positive Tuesday for an anti-inflammatory drug. Now, I have two questions on this story, Bill. Number one, how'd you like to be the guy in charge of drug testing the bulls? Wouldn't that be fun? Get your bucket and follow me. Second of all, what can we say about this except, in the immortal words of Mel Brooks, Mongo only pawn in Game of Life.
Earlier in the program, we heard about cockroach racing at the
Indiana
State Fair.
It's only a game, and some of them are really weird.
They're little tiny racers. Etymology buffs in our audience will be pleased to know that the plucky pests were also in the news this week for disrupting a dominoes tournament in Singapore. They are, in fact, everywhere.
It's a big week for cockroaches, ladies and gentlemen. First, you have those guys with Ted Williams' body. Ma Luya, who's a domino laying expert from Beijing, is going for the world record. And apparently one of the people already holding the record has hired a group of cockroaches to sabotage the effort. Miss Luya wants to topple 350,000 tiles on Monday, but unfortunately the cockroaches keep getting in and knocking them down 8,000 and 9,000 at a time. Now, you're laughing at me because of my obvious conspiratorial bent here, but we've got guys taking pot shots at bass fishermen and doped-up steers. Can hiring cockroaches be far behind?
What do you hire a cockroach with? Twinkies?
Rotting food. I can give you 12 pounds of rotting beef if you knock over these dominoes.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and bugs me each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Several years ago, a New York City photographer stumbled upon a group of workers fishing from the grounds of a sewage treatment plant on their lunch break. It inspired him to produce Gotham Fish Tales, a video documentary featuring people who fish in the city. This summer, reporter John Kalish caught up with the producer and some of the brave local characters who fish New York waters.
Early on a weekday morning, photographer Robert Moss fishes from a motorboat anchored off Ellis Island in New York Harbor. The plan is to snag a striped bass or bluefish for a screening of his new documentary, Gotham Fish Tales.
People who've lived here all their lives, vast majority of them, have no idea what kind of a resource is here. There are amazing number of species, and some of these species exist in great numbers. Great numbers of striped bass, great numbers of bluefish, great numbers of fluke and flounder, blackfish, sea bass.
This morning, Moss and his partner land a bluefish and a striped bass.
Whoa, I got him. Hey, he's right there.
Keep steady with him.
Right on the surface.
Bass.
Yeah.
That's a nice one, boy.
Is that a beautiful clean fish or what? Look at that.
The 10-pound striper is 28 inches long, just big enough to keep under New York law. The bluefish is more than 30 inches long. They will be cooked by a chef at a fancy downtown restaurant and served to a throng of people at a Gotham Fishtail screening. Moss has been struck by the appeal fishing has in the city, a basic instinct he attributes to man's roots as a hunter-gatherer. Moss himself is willing to trespass on private property to get to a desirable fishing spot. Once in Queens, he climbed out on a rock jetty in the Atlantic and got caught in high tide. Moss says there is something more than the challenge of figuring out when to fish and what bait to use that appeals to people who fish in the city.
Fishing represents a way for people to connect with the natural world in settings that most people find unlikely. But for them, the individuals, is really real and meaningful. And whether somebody hooks a fish in that situation or not, a lot of times doesn't even matter.
I fished around the Statue of Liberty in autumn.
Angler John Waldman is staff scientist at the Hudson River Foundation.
It was one day there where a professional fishing guide who fishes the harbor took me out, and we had about 75 stripers in a few hours. The most fun part of that was that as we were landing the fish, the Staten Island Ferry passed by, and everybody came out to watch us. And as we pulled the fish on board, we had a standing ovation. From everyone on the Staten Island Ferry. So, you know, where else can you experience that?
But since September 11th, 2001, some fishing spots in New York Harbor have been off limits. Joe Chaste is a local fishing guide.
We used to fish inches from the shore of Liberty Island, and now there's about a 125-yard barrier of buoys. You can't go past those. And the other restrictions around the UN, Battery, Governor's Island, I don't think it's going to change too soon either.
One thing that has changed for the better is water quality in New York Harbor. By the late 1970s, widespread treatment of sewage resulted in a dramatic improvement of the oxygen level in the harbor. John Waldman wrote Heartbeats in the Muck, an environmental history of New York Harbor.
A tuna fish showed up in the harbor last year. There's a small kind of tuna called the false albacore, which looks like a big bluefin tuna on a smaller scale. It's a very fast, clear water loving fish that was never found inside the harbor until last year, where they showed up in the East River under the Brooklyn Bridge. And that's testimony to the recovery of the waters. They don't like polluted or murky water. And there they were in September chasing baitfish under the Brooklyn Bridge.
50-year-old cab driver Philip Frabasillo drives around with fishing rods and fresh bait in his trunk. He makes sinkers out of spark plugs wrapped with electrical tape. This afternoon, he's fishing on Roosevelt Island in the East River. Frabasillo figures he's caught more than 10,000 fish in the river. He caught one of them in a park near the mayor's residence, Gracie Mansion.
There was a little girl sitting next to me, and she was telling me, "Nobody ever fishes here. It's silly. Don't fish here." And I said, "Well, there's fish in the water, young lady." And while we were talking, one of my really big 12-foot sticks started to jump, and I have it tied down up there because you have a real strong current there. So I gathered a crowd of about 25 people around me, and they watched this bluefish become an acrobat, because bluefish tend to be show-offs. And he jumped out of the water about 11 times in his strong current. And I finally got him up, and he was 13 pounds.
Frabasillo admits that on occasion he'll keep more fish than he's entitled to legally. But he has disdain for his fishing brethren who take home catches that are under the legal limit, a practice he says that is widespread on Manhattan's Upper East Side.
Along the FDR Drive, you have between 30 and 70 fishermen there on a weekend, and maybe 30 bass are caught on a whole weekend. That area tends to produce little fish. I would be stunned if more than two fish went back. None of the fish they catch there are legal. So I don't think those people ever seen a keeper over there.
On a pier in the Bay Ridge section of Brooklyn, tiny gulls dive at bait whenever people cast into the bay. About a dozen fishing rods are leaning against a rail. Visible in the hazy distance are some huge container ships, the Statue of Liberty, and the lower Manhattan skyline. Carlos Perez, a 35-year-old auto mechanic, caught a sand shark here recently, and he regularly reels in stingrays. Perez complains that the sewage plant near the pier smells from time to time, and occasionally so do the fish that he catches.
Sometimes you got some fish that doesn't look good. You got some fish that comes with spots. Some of them come out smelly. If I see that the fish doesn't look too good, throw them back in.
But today he's got a styrofoam case of ice-cold beer and a cool breeze in his face. He's joined by his friend, bus driver Robert Chico, who's hoping to bring home some bluefish for a backyard barbecue.
Put them in aluminum foil, you throw the onions and peppers on top with a little seasoning if you want, usually the ground black pepper. You know, half hour one way, half hour the other, and they come out nice and white and tender and delicious.
But New York environmental authorities advise that people not eat more than one meal of fish caught in these waters per month. Across the bay in New Jersey, officials say those same fish shouldn't be consumed more than four times a year. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
So I've been a lake, you know, I'm gonna catch me a fish. I'm gonna get someone that's gonna call my meat. Everybody fishing. Everybody fishing. Everybody fishing, I believe I'll fish some too.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or view photos of the Connecticut Sun as they battled and eventually lost to the New York Liberty, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Jesse Hicks of the Sun, who claims that she can tell at warm-ups if her team is ready to play.
If I see somebody, like, moving side to side, rocking, like, in church, you know, they say the Holy Ghost is in them. You know, but if you see them rocking, I think that means they're ready.
I wonder if that explains the gentle swaying from side to side of the one-armed bandit players at the casino just on the other side of the wall. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Everybody fishing, I believe I'll fish some too. I'm going to Memphis or Tennessee. I found a woman man love for me because everybody fishing. Everybody fishing. Everybody fishing. I believe I fish.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.